This is Content Content, a monthly podcast featuring technical communicators and web content professionals. I'm Ed Marsh. This is episode number 2, recorded February 16th, 2015. It's President's Day here in the United States, a federal holiday. Today's guest is Alan Hauser, a Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania-based technical communication consultant. He is the co-founder and president of his business, Group Wellesley, since the year 2000. Of course, I first got to know Alan via Twitter, where he's been consistently at the top of MindTouch's TechCom influencers list. I can't say that word. You can find Alan on Twitter at ARH. Nice handle, by the way. I met Alan in person at the STC Philly Metro Chapter Annual Conference, where we quickly hit it off. The STC Philly Conference is coming up on March 27th. It's a great, fun day if you're in the area. Rarely do you get such an intimate opportunity to network and speak with some of the leaders in technical communication, content strategy, security, and recruiting. Alan is a heavy hitter in the TechCom world, with several leadership positions in the Society for Technical Communication, both at the chapter and national levels. In addition to organizing the STC Summit, he is a past STC president and an STC fellow. I'm glad he's here with me in the very cold Eastern time zone today. How's the weather by you? Is it as bad as it is here in New Jersey, Alan?
I think we have a bit less snow than you may have, but it's frigid. Both my boys are off school today. School was canceled because of the cold temperature.
Oh, wow.
But what can you do?
Yeah, it's about 20 degrees here right now with the wind chill. It's about 8 degrees. So I'm going to stay here where it's nice and warm, and we'll have a little chat.
Okay, great. Okay. Ed, it's a privilege to be on your show. I listened to your first episode. I thought it was amazing. And I'm just really blown away that you pinged me for episode number 2.
Well, thanks for coming on, Alan. You know, you have a wealth of knowledge, both about DITA and structured authoring, as well as our career paths with the STC. So I'm looking forward to a great conversation.
Okay. Yeah, you mentioned my Twitter handle, ARH. I have one of those rare three-letter Twitter handles. And, you know, my fantasy is that some multinational corporation with the initials ARH will come on board and try to buy it from me, and I'll be able to retire. But that hasn't happened so far. Here's hoping.
Yeah, I'll keep my fingers crossed.
Thanks.
Along those lines, though, I thought you might like to know that when I Googled you, the ad at the bottom of the page noted I could find Alan Hauser for less on eBay. I chose not to take him up on that offer, though.
Right. There is another Alan Hauser out there, so I won't say he's an imposter. He seems to be a nice guy. Maybe you may get him instead of me.
I only want the original Alan Hauser, so I won't take my chances on eBay. So Alan, why don't you tell us about your background, a little bit about what Group Wellesley does?
Okay. Well, Ed, I operate essentially as an independent consultant, and I'm one of those people, I think just because of my work in STC, my presence in social media, some of the publishing I've done, most people know me, as Alan Hauser. Group Wellesley Incorporated happens to be a corporate structure that, I created, about 10 years ago. I've been doing independent consulting for 15 years. Originally I started the business with my wife. We both met, in the Carnegie Mellon Masters in Professional Writing Program. We started a business in 2000, and we wanted a distinguished sounding name. So we picked Group Wellesley. We spent a lot of time in Massachusetts, where Wellesley is well known. What we did not know is that nobody outside of New England can spell Wellesley, and it's a very it has an odd cadence to it. So even spelling it out for people, I'm actually you know, undergoing some thought about rebranding and changing the name. But yeah, you'll see me doing business as Group Wellesley, and I try to sell myself as one who improves technical communication processes. And if you look at my signature, I'm a consultant and a trainer. So I provide training in things like structured authoring, XML, DITA, and some plain old tools training like FrameMaker, Structured FrameMaker, Oxygen, XMetal. And another tool I really enjoy training on is Adobe Captivate, in part because it's just different from the others. So that's a little summary of you know, what I do, what I try to provide.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, I'm a fan of Captivate myself. We don't get many requests for it where I am, but now I happen to have three or four on my plate. So it's nice to take a step back and play around and have a little fun with the e-learning. So, Alan, can you tell us a little bit about your STC history? How did you decide to get involved in both chapter and then national leadership, culminating as president of the STC?
Okay, well, supporting the STC has been, aside from family things, probably my life's greatest privilege. It's just such an outstanding organization, and I was an STC lurker for years and years. I spent most of the 90s in New England. My first job out of college was with Hewlett-Packard in Chelmsford, Massachusetts. And I attended STC events. I have an old STC Interchange conference brochure from 1992, I believe, that I hang on to. And it's just interesting to see some of the names that are the same and different from those events. So I was a lurker for many years, but then I relocated back to Pittsburgh with my wife in the late 90s. I became very active in the Pittsburgh chapter, I believe programming manager, and then I was president of the Pittsburgh chapter in the early part of the last decade. And I remember Thea Teich once visited the Pittsburgh chapter. We were having a banquet or some sort of award ceremony, and she tapped me on the shoulder and she said to me something like, "We're considering you for international service," and it just knocked me out that somebody would recognize me that way and give me that encouragement. And that's something that tap on the shoulder is something that I continue to talk about. I think any of us who have served the STC in almost any capacity got their start by somebody saying, "Hey, you know, you can do this. You can step up. There are bigger things ahead for you if you want to pursue them." So I'll always remember that. And I'm trying to remember how I got started supporting the International Society. I have had several roles. I came up through, I believe it was the Baltimore Conference 2004. I'm in a large room with lots of people. And I believe it was Felice Banner and Jack Molisani. They were looking for somebody to serve on the conference committee, the programming committee. Okay. And I just heard my name from across the room. And one of them said, "There's your guy." And next thing, I was on the conference committee helping with the programming. And I rose through that. I was eventually program chair and conference chair. I believe I was conference chair would be the lead, program chair would be the person, the lead person responsible for the call for proposals and the system for reviewing the submissions and determining the content of the conference tracks. And then above that would be conference chair. Conference chair is the lead volunteer responsible for the content of the conference.
Okay.
So the way it works, the STC office does the business side of things. They do the logistics. They do the hotel contracts. They acquire the space. They secure the vendors and do those contracts. But the philosophy of the office had been, and I believe still is, that it's the members who know the profession and the members who know what things are hot, what things are attractive, what things should be included in the STC Summit program. Hmm. So that side of the conference is really volunteer run. And then as conference chair, I was the lead volunteer in charge for the whole conference experience from a programming aspect, including things like keynotes, invited speakers, workshops, etc. And I served in that role for, I'm going to get the years wrong, but I think it was Dallas and Sacramento just before I got elected to the STC board.
So you kind of fell into this. How would you say someone who's interested in volunteering for STC or any organization, any volunteer organization, do you have any advice about how to start? Is it just volunteer, raise your hand and say, "Hey, give me something to do"? What do you suggest?
Well, so I think everybody's a little bit different, and what works for one person might not work for another. But I've always been a big fan of showing up. And if you're involved in an organization, show up. If you're involved at the local level, you know, go to the meetings. And when I became very active and very serious in STC, that's when I started going to the STC summit. Now, I'll admit, the summit was not the first professional conference I went to. One of the things I realized very quickly when I started independent consulting is that showing up has a big effect there. I think any consultant will tell you that I get a lot of my business from networking events and from professional events. So very, even when I knew I wanted to be a consultant but still had a day job, I positioned myself to attend appropriate professional conferences. For example, there was a sizable FrameMaker conference in the late 90s and early 2000s. And that was one of the ones where, you know, I attended, I got, I submitted proposals, I got on the program. That's one where I put my focus early. I probably attended Writers UA before I attended STC, but once I set my sights on STC volunteering at a higher level, then okay, got to attend the summit, got to show up there, and it's being a regular there at the STC summit and the STC regional events has really helped me both personally and professionally. It's been richly rewarding personally, just through the network of colleagues I've acquired. And also richly rewarding professionally, because I've gotten to do things that I probably never would have been able to do had I just stayed Alan Hauser, independent publishing consultant.
Well, we're all glad that you took that step forward. And your experience with the STC culminated as a society president, international president from 2012 and 2013. Can you tell us about your experience becoming president of an international society and some of the things maybe that you're most proud of?
Okay. Well, how much time do we have?
We could take care of that in editing.
Yeah. Okay. So I'll talk for 5 hours. You can cut it down to 5 minutes.
Perfect.
I think I had service on the SEC board in my sights. You know, I knew I wanted to run for the board someday, and I figured, oh, I'll finish my conference manager role, and then I'll take a year off, and I'll run for the board of directors as a director.
Okay.
And so the last year I was conference manager, I got a call from the SEC nominating committee. This is Mark Clifford, who was the chair at that time, and he said, Alan, how'd you like to run for SEC vice president? And this was, you know, I think this was a stretch for me. I was a little bit out of my comfort level. And it may have been a change for the society, because usually the VP had served on the board as a director and had, you know, maybe some other roles, committee. Well, I had been a committee chair, so I certainly had that role. But I think the office and the nominating committee and my peers had, I want to think they had a high degree of comfort with me, because on the conference committee, I had to work with the staff. I had to build teams. I had to build consensus. That's one of the things I think I'm good at. So they asked me to run for vice president. I said yes, and I won the election. Like, wow. so suddenly I'm on the STC board of directors. And once again, I don't think it was planned, but it was serendipitous. And serendipity happens when you show up. You certainly increase your chances of that. So that's how I got the role. Now, I was on the STC board in what I think is a fascinating time in the society's history. Fascinating, you know, maybe at the time, not in the most positive way. When I was elected, the society had experienced, I believe, 12 straight years of membership decline, 12 straight years of revenue decline, to the tune of each year's revenue was $200,000 to $300,000 less than the previous year's revenue. So the society, when I was elected to the board of directors, was about a $2.5 million a year revenue operation. and declining. Membership was declining. Membership is probably our most precious metric. We were approaching 5,000 members from the wrong direction. So, yeah, things were in a situation that was not sustainable, and I don't think the society was in imminent danger, but it was in certainly you cannot continue that sort of pattern for a very long period of time and sustain yourself as an organization. Mm-hmm. So, in my VP year, I got to work with our previous executive director, Catherine Burton. I got to work with then President Hillary Hart.
Okay.
And that was a good time for just me to get up to speed on serving on the board of directors and what that means, and to formulate my own opinions about what should potentially change when I became the chair of the board. So very early in my term, we decided to part ways, Catherine Burton and this society. And so during my term, we were without an executive director. And we knew the issues at hand. We knew what the society was facing. So we created the board of directors, created a search committee. That search committee was led by Nikki Blyle, who succeeded me as society president. Mm-hmm. And we worked with the search firm to identify the next executive director of the society, who we hired just as my term was finished. I believe I signed this contract on behalf of the board of directors in May 3rd of 2013. So that was at the summit in I'm embarrassed to draw a blank on where it wasn't Phoenix. It was the year before that. So wherever the summit was that year, and I'll be Chicago. No, Atlanta.
Okay. Yeah. I have to admit, I have never been to an STC summit. So, but I haven't been to many conferences overall. So
Ed, now you know the path to STC president.
Right. A very unique path, it sounds like. So could you tell us about some of your accomplishments and some of the things that happened on the positive side, and maybe a little bit about what it was like coming into a society that was facing that financial issue?
Okay. Well, one of the things I tried to do, I reached out for advice from past society presidents, past board members, professional colleagues who know I value knowing how things work.
Okay.
Things work a certain way for a certain reason, and knowing those things and those reasons can be very effective. One past society president told me, "Alan, learn Robert's Rules of Order. It's the key to getting things done. It's the key to building consensus." And I did that, and it's fascinating. The board of directors of any nonprofit association is a deliberative body. And if you think of Robert's Rules, you might think, you might think of stuffiness, and you might think of motions and calls to order. But these rules are very precise, and they're written in very particular ways for a reason. They actually empower a body to get things done.
Okay.
And I think one of a couple of things that were important to me as chair of the board of directors was educating that board in the fact that the board of directors is the ultimate the body with ultimate legal and fiscal authority for the organization.
Okay.
Not the executive director or CEO. Mm. It's the buck start the viability of the organization rests on the board of directors. And so whether previous boards got that or not, I don't know, but the board of directors, there's a risk that it can become too friendly with the CEO or executive director or whatever the paid staff member is. And that's something a board has to watch for. So and the other that is that every member of the board has essentially equal authority within that body.
Okay.
There is a board chair who leads meetings and, you know, handles procedural things. But really, you know, every member of the body has equal voice. So let's see. So trying to remember where I was going. So the board is the ultimate entity responsible for the organization. We knew we needed to find somebody with exemplary business skills, financial skills, somebody who could build relationships with other organizations, and somebody strategic, but with a very good business sense, set goals and measure performance against those goals, constant feedback, etc. And we actually found a person who I've been quite pleased with. His name is Chris Lyon, so he's the current CEO of the society. Okay. And I'm trying to remember his background. He spent some time I'm going to get the branch wrong. I believe the Navy, spent a long time with IBM, had not a lifetime association person, but somebody who could assess our situation and execute. So, and let me close on that note. The board of directors, as the ultimate body responsible for the organization, has one employee, and that is the executive director or CEO, whatever the board declares the title to be. So one employee, that's the person who executes the board's mission. The board's vision, and that person should be given a budget to hire staff, etc., to pay for office space, and the board would be hands off of that except for setting direction and providing that budget. So board of directors hires one employee, and that employee executes the board's mission. And that to me is a fascinating distinction about nonprofit boards, or even for-profit boards, and how they are set up. So I'm still being circuitous here, but it's a kind of a fascinating time in my life. So I tend to ramble about it. In terms of things I'm proud of, the STC is now, I'm no longer on the board of directors. I'm not privy to the monthly financial statements, but the numbers are exposed. They do become public with the STC's tax filings. I believe the form is 990 that they have to file every year. So my understanding is that society finances are stable and improving, that investments are being replenished, and that membership is definitely stable or increasing. I believe a year or two ago was the first year that society membership actually increased. So I believe the number is around 6,000, not the 5,000 that we were flirting with. So I'm very pleased so far that I think the society is in a much better position than it was originally. And I can continue to ramble on some hard things and some things I'm proud of, depending on how far you want to go.
If you want to point out one or two things, that'd be great. If not, we can move on.
Oh, okay. Yes. So in addition to, I believe my board stabilized the society, we did create some new programs. There's an SEC imprint program, which identifies exemplary works, typically printed, published works in the field. And it's basically a lightweight imprint. And so Liz Poland, the publications director, is shepherding that. The other one, maybe even bigger, one important thing for the society is to increase outreach with academia and industry. So we created an industry advisory council staffed with, basically director level and above people from academia, from tools vendors, from companies that employ substantial numbers of technical communicators. And that's been a way for this body to meet with the board of directors and do knowledge sharing, help to set the direction of the society, help to identify how the society can serve its members and the profession better than it currently is. So So I've been very pleased with that. So.
Fantastic. Okay, great. Well, thanks for your perspective. It's interesting to see, you know, how the board works and how the society works. I didn't know we had an executive director that was a full-time employee. So interesting look back on your time with the STC.
Oh, absolutely. Right. And the STC, it has a staff of about 10. And, you know, I mentioned the budget. So you have several different programs: membership, publications, education, the conference, and each of these take time and money to execute. So it's all good. I'm very pleased with the organization and where it's going.
All right, let's change gears a little bit. But first, I'd like to tell everyone about a website for content professionals and technical communicators called contentcontent.info. This is a site I created about a year ago. Probably needs a design refresh, but really what it boils down to is it is a place for content strategy and user experience, technical writers and designers to come to get all of their news from one location. It's a bunch of RSS feeds. There are about 35 different feeds out there of blogs and professional organizations, chapters of the STC, and of course, famous content strategists, all in one place. It gets updated daily automatically, and all the links go directly to the website. It gives you a little blurb there for you to take a look and see if that's the information you're looking for. Once again, contentcontent.info. Go check it out. Thanks. So, Alan, when I was doing my research for you, realized you were quite a bit of a techie, which, you know, intrigued me even more. So you were also on the OASIS DITA Technical Committee, and you were the STC liaison to the W3C, which, if you don't know, the W3C is the body that it sets standards for HTML and CSS. Can you tell us a little bit about your experiences on both those committees?
Okay, so let's see. I'll start with the W3C. For years, the STC had a liaison to the World Wide Web Consortium, and actually had a standards committee that had representatives on OASIS. OASIS is a big standards body. W3C, IEEE, and ISO. So STC had representatives in those standards organizations, and one of the painful things the STC did while it was writing its financial ship was it had to back off some of these investments. I think standards is a big investment that STC pulled out of, and certification is another. Program that unfortunately STC had to suspend and reevaluate. But at that time, up until a year or two ago, STC was funding these standards organizations. Now, standards organizations they tend to be expensive, and the standards process, if you're a fan of government or nonprofit or association boards and know the pace that these things work, well, you know, working standards should be right up your alley. It's a collaborative it's a collaborative process. It's a consensus building process. There are also some big legal issues. There are issues of antitrust, of collusion. You have companies of intellectual property. You have companies coming into rooms together and collaborating on how things should work. And, you know, this collaboration has to happen in an environment that protects the intellectual property of each individual company. So that's just a long way of saying that lawyers are usually involved, not directly. They're not sitting around the table, but they are involved in on the staffs of these standards organizations, so the membership fees tend to be pretty hefty. Okay. I think the STC was paying $5,000 or $6,000 a year for its W3C membership alone. Jeez. And that was a nonprofit rate. The lowest for-profit rate to join the W3C was about $50,000.
My goodness.
Yes.
Wow. So things you don't think about.
Right, absolutely. And the other issue with STC's participation in standards is exactly what standards should the society advocate, or what positions on features of standards should the society advocate? And I think even for something like DITA, which is so clearly in the realm of technical communication, that's a very hard question to answer. What features for the person representing STC on the DITA technical committee, what features should they be advocating? And maybe they don't advocate features. Maybe they just contribute to the process, and that's very important as well. I'm doing a little bit of thinking out loud here. So I did represent the STC on the W3C for about 3 years, 2 or 3 years. Neil Perlin I succeeded Neil Perlin. On that panel, and at that time it was basically advisory and reporting back, attending W3C meetings and making the STC's presence known and reporting back to the STC. So we actually did have somebody who participated in, I believe, the HTML5 specification as well. So that's another thing. Our membership opened up the ability for STC members to participate in working groups of the W3C. So that's I regret that the STC is not currently doing that, but I think the STC would need to identify some issues, like if we are in standards, what does that mean for our membership? What value is that going to bring? What position should we advocate? Let me shift gears and talk about the DITA Technical Committee, because that was one that I participated on as Alan Hauser, independent consultant, Group Wellesley Inc. So I paid my own membership for that. And OASIS, fortunately, OASIS stands for, I'm not even going to try it, because live I'm not going to get it. But I'm not going to get it right. But they're another standards body. And they happen to have a lower entry point for independent consultants of, at the time, $300 or $400 a year. Now, the corporate rate, if I wanted to join as Group Wellesley Incorporated and be able to publicize my OASIS membership, I think it'd be several thousand dollars. So the standards participation can be expensive. But standards participation is important, because the DITA spec did not just come out of the sky. The DITA spec was created by IBM. It was put in the public domain. IBM donated it to OASIS, and this public technical committee was formed to continue to maintain and develop and promote DITA, the specification. And that technical committee, one thing that's fascinated me in my travels is that no matter how high the stature of the people you're dealing with are, they're all just people. So the DITA Technical Committee is just people. They're colleagues of mine. They're people I see at conferences. You see their name in print and meet them in person. They're brilliant, but at some level they're just they're just people that care about the specification and devote a substantial amount of time to developing it. Some of the members of the DITA Technical Committee work for corporations like IBM and tools vendors and have other corporate interests, so they're on the company payroll. Many are independent consultants like I am. And so they are essentially donating their time or seeing it as a marketing expense. So that's probably another roundabout, circuitous diatribe about standards and about the DITA Technical Committee in general. So to be clear, I'm no longer on the DITA TC. I think I dropped off shortly before I ran for the STC Board of Directors, but I am considering getting back into it. And I can certainly talk in more detail about what's involved with standards and what some of the weaknesses are, some of the strengths are, some of the issues going forward.
Interesting. So it sounds like you're the kind of person who likes committees and likes reaching out across different communities.
Yeah, I like to think of myself as a consensus builder, and many people are frustrated by the pace of organizations, the pace of boards, the pace of committees, the pace of governance, but things happen. I believe in time as a tool. And I use time as a tool in my term on the SDC Board of Directors. Some things take time for very good reasons.
That's a good attitude to have, I think, especially working with all these committees and subcommittees and different people. So, Alan, we probably should have taken a step back, and I know you have experience with DITA. Can you tell us a little bit about DITA, what DITA is? Maybe give us a little basics of DITA for those who don't know what DITA or structured authoring might be.
Okay, well that's a good point, Ed. Let's see. So DITA is an architecture. I'm trying not to reuse words here. DITA stands for Darwin Information Typing Architecture, and it is an architecture for creating, managing, and delivering technical content. The key features of DITA are the topic as the core unit, and which enables reuse, and also serves as a basis for what DITA calls specialization into more strongly defined information types. DITA out of the box comes with task, concept, and reference information types. I believe there are a handful of other types that are now in the base spec, and there are some yet more types in the pipeline for inclusion in the next revision of the DITA spec, which would be DITA 1.3,
right?
Which I believe that's very close to the OASIS ballot stage in which it would be approved. Those information types, I believe, simplified DITA is a big one, and the troubleshooting task, just to talk about some of the new information types. But DITA doesn't constrain you to the types it provides, the information types it provides. It has a mechanism called specialization, which lets you create your own information types and still conform to the DITA architecture. So you can still create your own information types and still use authoring tools and publishing tools and content management tools that support DITA, because your information is to the tools, it's just DITA. So I know I left out some things in that in the last 2 minutes. Certainly the DITA maps for aggregating types into deliverables, the DITA mechanisms for reusing content, mechanisms for filtering content. So topic oriented. Strong support for information typing, strong support for content reuse, strong support for filtering. That's probably a good 20-second DITA summary.
Nice. Now, do you use DITA or suggest DITA to your clients depending on their needs?
Well, I think the answer is yes, and the key there is depending on their needs.
I think that's a caveat everyone needs to consider when they move or don't move to DITA or considering structured authoring.
Right. And I think I've developed the reputation as the DITA consultant that doesn't like DITA.
And well, tell me more about that.
DITA is a grand slam home run where it's appropriate. And it can be an utter fiasco in situations where it's not appropriate. In part because it's a complex architecture. So there are lots of pieces of DITA, lots of things you can do with DITA. Some of the DITA gurus would claim you don't have to use all of DITA. You can pick and choose what you want. But you're still, you're picking and choosing from something that's pretty complex. And at the end of the day, some people just need a manual. Some people just need a help system. And there are reasons we have off-the-shelf tools that let you do this, pretty quickly, pretty easily. With DITA, you have amazing capabilities that the architecture gives you, but you tend to have to do a lot more work on your own. And so that's sort of the veneer of some of the issues that I have with DITA, and some of the reasons that I might recommend against DITA instead of for DITA, like you said, depending on the circumstance. Yeah. I could tell you a story.
Go ahead. Stories are great.
Okay. Yeah. So I have this sort of this longstanding envy of the web development community. Both the people that create code and the people that create content in that community. And this kind of goes to the way technical writers look at XML versus the way people in other communities look at XML. So I was I went to a coffee shop in a gourmet hot dog shop. Not that that detail is important, but I went to a gourmet hot dog shop in my neighborhood.
Nice.
And I recognize one of the web development gurus from the Pittsburgh area in that coffee shop. And she's at a table surrounded by other people that I recognize. And I realize, there was a web design conference in town. And, these are like the key people. These are the speakers, many of the speakers from that that conference. And I recognize Sarah. Everybody butchers her name. Sarah Watcher Betcher.
Yes.
I don't know if you've heard of her.
Yes, I've read her book. I loved her book.
Her book is like astonishing. It's the, can I say it's the best content strategy book I've read? Just the it hits the right level of detail. It's broad and it goes deeper technically than a lot of the other books. You know, it talks about content APIs in a pretty deep level. And I think, wow, this is awesome. So I love her book. And so she's there, and I have to say hello. So I go, I'm interrupting this group, but they're cool. And I say, I'm Alan Hauser, I'm president of the STC, blah, blah, blah. And I don't know how in this 2 minutes, but I probably asked her about it because it's been a big issue for me about, what she thinks of XML and the utility, et cetera. And she said something to the effect of, one thing you guys in technical communication do is, when you go technical very quickly, when you're talking about content strategy, when you're kind of talking about content reuse, you go to XML right away. And the web development community doesn't necessarily do that. The web development community has, different ways of teaching and enforcing structured authoring, template-based systems, editorial systems, examples, but we go straight to big heavyweight XML-based systems, which tend to be complex and they're appropriate for the right thing, but they just put up a barrier to entry that you don't see in other content communities, in marketing content, in web content. And I thought that was a very insightful comment from her. And I've been dealing with XML for a long time. I think XML was ratified as a spec in 1998. It's 2015 now, so that's 17 years. And in every place except TechCom, XML has kind of found a steady state, but in TechCom, XML is still the future, and that's there's some issue there, especially if you read Tom Johnson's recent articles, if you see the renewed interest in very loose authoring languages like Markdown. So there's some issues there with XML that I have some theories, but I think there's some barriers to adoption that need to come down before XML can really achieve widespread deployment in technical communication.
As someone who has just implemented a data solution at work, I agree the complexity is by committee. as I said in my prior podcast, I was against anti-data for many, many years because of the complexity of implementing it and also the cost of implementing it in both time and resources and external consultants and XSLT developers and everything else. But it does seem like DITA has made a bit of a comeback, or at least structured authoring has made a bit of a comeback, or is becoming larger in content strategy and tech comm. Do you think that XML is the answer for this? I mean, you could do structure using classes and HTML if you really wanted to, but I think the part of the complexity is part of data's appeal when you're actually implementing it. What do you think is, you know, if we're the future is now with data and XML, what's the next future for structured authoring?
Okay, well, I think it's a big world, and one thing I don't know if the XML purists and the data purists acknowledge is that you can have explicit structure enforced through XML schemas or DTDs and architectures like DITA and DocBook, and you can have implicit structure enforced by patterns, enforced by examples. You know, this is the ACME corporate standard task. It has these components, and everybody that writes a task should adhere to that standard by example. So, and I think there's room for lots and lots of different solutions. Actually, lots and lots of different solutions are required. And one mistake we make in TechCom, some of the evangelists make, is that we propose XML as a solution for everything. And we propose DITA as a solution for everything. I've seen there are blog posts out there you can find that propose that because a website reuses some content, of course, all of its content should be in DITA. And I'm thinking back to a recent Tom Johnson podcast. He's interviewing an API writer, and the writer has this, you know, very sleek workflow based on Markdown. Markdown is, to those that don't know it, it's a very loosely structured authoring format based on text and based on symbols. Like, you know, to create a header, you insert a hash symbol in front of your text. To create a bullet, you insert a dash sign or a plus or a number. And so it gives you very, very fast, lightweight ways to create content. And Tom asked the API writer, what about reuse? What if you want a PDF of this API reference? And the writer almost didn't understand the question. Like, why would I want to do that? he has this slick workflow that lets him create content and publish it in the format that the customer or the user expects, and use that content effectively. And yet, why should he look at a DITA workflow? What's the gain? His requirements are met, and they're met very well. So once again, another circuitous answer that there are all kinds of one thing I've learned as a consultant, I used to feel a little bit bad about, you know, why do I have to engage every company and charge a lot of money and, you know, tell them what to do? Why aren't these answers in a book? Why can't I just hand them a book, or hand everybody a book or a white paper or whatever that gives the answer? And the what I've learned is that every company's requirements differ substantially. You know, their resources, their business requirements, business constraints, customers. There's just so many factors one has to consider when choosing an appropriate solution. So, lots of different situations, lots of different solutions. And I think DITA is one that's very good in particular situations and just not good in others.
I will say, now that I have finally converted RoboHelp content to DITA, it is so much of a nicer experience to work in. I don't know if it's the tool. I'm using Oxygen, but the structure is oddly freeing. And I'm wondering, you know, if, you know, people can do their own structures. It seems like Markdown might be a little oversimplified for doing that kind of structure. I mean, it seems almost like it's a wiki markup language in that you really have limited styles and limited ways to do things. And as much as I'm a fan of simplicity, I think for me, maybe that would be not an ideal situation to work in with Markdown, or it's one of those, even wiki markup, because we're publishing to Confluence, was just way too simple for what we wanted to do. And I you know, again, not one size fits all, but have you had an experience with Markdown or people editing or working in Markdown on a professional level? Your TechCom, at least.
Yeah. I would say not for conventional tech comm outside the API documentation world. So I see it used effectively in web content development, web copy development, a little bit of Markom, but I think, to suggest that Markdown is an appropriate option for mainstream technical communication is probably not, not appropriate. Unless possibly, and this is thinking out loud, unless it's you have a highly segregated environment where authors work in Markdown and then it goes to production people who may tag it more richly. And you actually had that environment in a lot of the early HTML and XML workflows where authors would write and send the content to taggers who would actually apply the tags. So that's a possibility, but... for conventional techcom, probably not. I think Markdown's strengths, and I think this is an issue for DITA. Many times a header is just a header, a bullet is just a bullet, and a paragraph is just a paragraph, and a step is just a step. And if you're in a situation where that is true, Markdown can be very, very effective in Markdown. DITA, on the other hand, gives you semantic containers for all of these with 20 possible attributes for every element, every para, every header.
Right. Yeah. Right.
So you have this, on one hand, Markdown with a very minimalist framework. There's not much opportunity for semantic information. And then DITA, on the other hand, very heavyweight framework with lots of places for semantic information, maybe too much, and I think the simplified DITA effort is looking at that. The other effort that's encouraging in DITA is there's been some traffic. I'm trying to remember. It might have been Yarno Alaverta, who is the lead developer for the DITA Open Toolkit, introduced or spoke recently. I don't know if it was his idea, but spoke recently of the idea that. Does a DITA document need to be XML? Is XML a requirement for a DITA document? Or if you can express the semantics in other file formats, and maybe convert to DITA XML, maybe that's sufficient. So that's an interesting possibility for the future of DITA.
Can you tell us a little bit about, is it lightweight DITA? I'm sorry, can you refresh my memory? It's lightweight or... simplified DITA.
Yes, and I'm not even certain I'm getting the name right, but it's basically a minimalist framework for creating content, and I'm drawing a blank for more than that, but the structures were chosen to represent what most people need for creating. Simple content.
Okay, interesting.
And that's part of the DITA 1.3 spec, which is due out. I would say sometime in 2015, from what I know.
Yeah, well, they said HTML5 was going to be out a long time ago too, when it's still not a formal standard yet. So I won't hold my breath.
Yeah.
Now going back to Tom Johnson's most recent blog post, which is called XML and the Web Drifting Further Apart. He seems to like the JSON format, which is a simple key-value pair. I'm wondering, he has a really long write-up and a lot of good commentary was brought up in his blog. But he doesn't really seem to have a solution other than XML. And I'm wondering, it's obviously not a one-size-fits-all approach, but do you think that there can be something else other than DITA or XML that tech writers can pick up? And I think, a lot of it has to do with tool choices too. I don't think a lot of people decided that XML was the way to go. It was kind of, I think, forced upon us for a while. Do you think that there's something coming out there or something that tech writers should be using?
Let's see. I hope so. Now, again, I'm a believer in a big tent and there are lots of tools out there and that are appropriate for lots of different situations. But when I rail a little bit against XML, and I don't think I'm railing against XML, I'm railing against using it in situations that are not appropriate. You may find it hard to believe that my sense of importance of XML is actually increasing, or I think XML is becoming more important. And one of the reasons for that is many of our tools in technical communication are very old. You know, some of the popular tools have code bases that are 25 or 30 years old, and it shows. The other danger in some of these tools is that they use binary file formats. And one tools vendor has an 18-month release cycle. They are changing the binary file format every month, 18 months. And these tools, they tend to be forward compatible. You know, you can open, you know, if you have version, you have version 20 and you get version 21, version 21 will open your version 20 files. So, you know, you can open older binary file formats. But still, that's a lot of binary files. And in this age where we want information, where information is precious, all information has always been precious. But I think a text-based file format is just much, much, much safer for an organization. You know, the portability of XML, the longevity of the XML file format is something I think is of ever increasing importance.
Right. And another thing I like about DITA and XML is that, you can basically port it to any place that you'd like. If there's another new standard coming out that's going to be the new HTML, you can convert to it fairly quickly. If you need all of the UI controls that are in your documentation, you can do that fairly quickly. And I think some of these more basic technologies, while they're useful, I don't know if it's really the best answer for everyone, like you said. I was actually at a meetup fairly recently in New York City, and I was talking to these young tech writers who were at a startup. I was at the meeting, I wasn't presenting. And I started talking to them about DITA, and they kind of gave me a blank stare. Some of them are using different tools, but no one had any clue about XML, and it really didn't sound like they needed it. So I was kind of happy that they weren't moving to it. They were doing it in a slow, in a very friendly approach and pretty much just in the browser.
So Ed, if I may ask, was there a phase of your project that was the most difficult or either most difficult or most surprisingly difficult? I have one that shows up. I have my pet peeve phase that is always really hard, and that I'd like to hear from you first.
Well, we did something very unique. So it was, it's been a bit of a struggle from start to finish. We developed a DITA to Confluence workflow. And basically we had all our content in HTML, figured out it was actually easier to convert to DITA than it was to Wiki markup because Confluence has this unique hybrid language behind the scenes. So we basically created a workflow from start to finish using a lot of custom ANT scripts and a lot of stuff. But for me personally, there was lots of pain points. It's now working, so it's fantastic, and it's really working out well. But it was a struggle to get start to finish. I think probably for me, the biggest pain point was trying to understand XSLT, to convert some of our classes and, specific IDs and classes in RoboHelper in HTML over to DITA was pulling teeth, and it wasn't perfect. I got some things to work, but it was it's the complexity of it all is just really getting things in and out via XSLT, I think, is probably my biggest pain point with DITA.
So I'm hearing as a root of that issue, the issue of conversion. You know, converting your content to XML, from whatever legacy format it's in to your new XML representation. And that part, I've never seen an easy conversion. it always requires lots of work, lots of analysis, lots of manual cleanup.
Right.
So I get a little bit angry when I see somebody who does a podcast of about easy conversion to DITA. So, make your conversion project easy. They are lying. I don't have the magic bullet. If there were a way to make those conversions easier, I think that would go a long way to increasing the adoption of XML. And sort of a side rant on that, I'm struck by, it's almost humorous when I think about it. We are as technical writers, technical communicators, we are so well trained, many of us, and there's certainly a path for those that aren't, in best practices like structured authoring, topic-oriented authoring, information typing, content reuse, filtering, and so we're, you know, we have these best practices, but when we still publish monolithic documents, you know, whether it's a PDF or whether it's a help system, you know, we author all this content, fine-grained content, strongly typed, and we hit publish and we generate 1,000 HTML pages that are all indexed and interlinked and have navigation. There's something wrong with that model. I feel like the publishing side has to go topic oriented as well. Another story. I was talking to a client. I had helped migrate them to XML about 10 years ago, and the manager. I had lunch with the manager to see how things are going, and she said to me something to the effect of, "They were happy with the experience, but they were just now getting into some of the capabilities they had promised management 10 years ago. capabilities like being able to embed content easily in the interface, being able to exchange content easily, being able to integrate content from acquisitions and vendors easily, and you know, a lot of that was this idea, you know, that on the publishing side we are still stuck in some, you know, pretty old processes, pretty set in our ways. And I'm struck by how hard publishing is in general, and that includes conversion. You mentioned converting from Confluence to another format to XML. You know, any conversion process is difficult. And I wish I had the answer, how can it be made easier? And that's right. One of my life's quests.
Right. It's there's something that's got to be there. It's too hard to publish now. You know, I was looking before this project started, I was thinking, hey, maybe I could use Drupal, the content management system, because I had experience with it. And there's nothing. There's one plugin module that was kind of abandoned, and there's no easy way to get our content into a modern content management system, like a web content management system. And I really think I think that's a great niche for someone if they can fill that and get a way to get to, you know, WordPress or Joomla or Drupal. I think that's really where the chance for opportunity is coming.
Yep, absolutely.
All right, Alan. Actually, I did want to ask you one more thing. I know via Twitter, you mentioned you recently visited the Twit Brickhouse, home of the famous Leo Laporte's Twit podcast network, and someone I hope to have on the show in the future. How was it for you going to podcasting Mecca?
Okay, so it was awesome. So just to give people some background, I'm an avid podcast listener. I love Tom Johnson's podcasts. I was thrilled to see Ed Marsh start this podcast. There are lots of content strategy podcasts out there. Karen McGrain's Responsive Design podcast. I'm missing her co-host, but the podcasts are just great ways to stay connected. And there are a couple of podcasting networks. The 5x5 network is one. Mm-hmm. I know Ed's a fan of Dan Benjamin and his work, and I enjoy their work. Mule Design with Mike Montero, who's a very irreverent, colorful character, does some good work.
Colorful indeed.
Yes, and you know, one of my favorites, This Week in Tech, who I think was probably a pioneer in the idea of podcasting and the podcasting network. So This Week in Tech is hosted by Leo Laporte. It's every Sunday, 6 o'clock Eastern time. They also have one Wednesday at 4 Eastern time called This Week in Google. And I try to listen to both live because, you know, it's just part of my ritual. Sunday evening, you know, I'm wrapping down. I can do sort of administrative things while I listen to This Week in Tech. So I hear it as it's happening. So This Week in Tech is based in Petaluma, California, about an hour north of San Francisco. And several weeks ago, I had the privilege of attending a broadcast in person. And it's a wonderful experience. You're going to be in the room with Leo, has a very wonderful presence. Silicon Valley Cognizanti either phone in or show up in person. So you have the tech journalists and Silicon Valley pundits, along with Leo, just taking the pulse of what's going on. It's an amazing facility, and a really, really cool experience. I thought it might be like sitting in church for 2 hours, but it was just very cool to be there, and I'd recommend it to anybody. And anything you want to add? Any in podcasts or any other insights?
Yeah, I've been a fan of Twit. It's been my Monday morning commute to work listen for many, many years now. I followed Leo when he was on TV it is not HGTV, it was ZDTV back in the late 90s, and I followed him ever since. Petaluma, California, also the home of Lagunitas Brewing Company, makers of some fine beers.
Yep.
So, hopefully I'll have a chance to go see Leo and maybe have him on the show. I am a big fan of different podcasts. I need to listen to more content strategy podcasts. It's kind of like my release, I think, which is why I like 5x5 and Merlin Mann with Back to Work. And also Triangulation from Twit is very good.
Triangulation is wonderful. And my only issue with podcasts is I cannot work and listen to a podcast. I cannot do anything that requires
thought. Oh, no, I can't either.
Okay, so there, it's wonderful for at the gym or if I'm doing menial tasks like tidying up the office. So that's how I carve out my time. When I'm jogging, I'm usually listening to Tom Johnson. Tom, if you hear that, nice. I hope that doesn't sound creepy. I'm grateful for him, all the wealth of information he shared with the field. And Ed, I'm pleased to see where this goes.
Thanks, Alan. Thank you very much. So tell us what's on your plate. What's coming up for Alan Hauser?
Oh, okay. Well, let's see. I'm not sure when you plan to release this podcast, and I fear the event may be sold out, but I'm dipping my toe in the water of hosting professional events. And we have Ceramatics coming to Washington, D.C. on March 20th, giving a full-day workshop in API documentation at Google. In downtown D.C., I believe two blocks from Union Station. Nice. So that's Friday, March 20th. It is entirely free. It's funny, when I set out to do an event, I started to do some budgeting, did some site acquisition work, etc. And I talked to Sarah, and she said, "Yeah, Google will provide the space. Yeah, wow. Google will provide the food." Yeah, Google provides snacks. Everything you need, Google will provide. And then she said, "But you can't charge for the event." So what's the phrase? Don't look a gift horse in the mouth.
Yeah, right.
I actually attended this Sarah's workshop in Santa Clara a couple weeks ago, Santa Clara, California, and it filled up there. I believe within 2 days of registration being announced. So we have 40 seats in D.C. I know it'll fill up. I hope people are hearing this in time to go to attend. So other than that, I'm supporting a couple of organizations and helping them improve their processes. And I'm actually seeing data in some surprising places.
Oh, interesting.
I hope I can talk about that sometime down the road.
We'll have to have you back on to talk about that when it comes to fruition.
Okay.
Remind us again, where can we find you online other than ARH on Twitter?
Okay, I think it's funny. Twitter's where I'm most comfortable. I like the 140 character limit. So online, certainly LinkedIn, Facebook. I'm old enough that I have my real name for a lot of these things, which is kind of cool. Alan.Hauser@gmail.com, and my company website is www.groupwellesley.com.
Fantastic. All right, Alan, thank you very much for being on Content. Your insight was fantastic, and I really enjoyed your stories. Until next time, my name is Ed Marsh. You can find me on Twitter at Ed Marsh or online at edmarsh.com. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you soon.